It's Wednesday, April 3rd, 2019, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. Hi. On our program this week, the newsworthiness of claims former Vice President and potential 2020 candidate Joe Biden has a pattern of inappropriately touching women. InfoWars host Alex Jones says it was a form of psychosis that led him to wage a campaign claiming the Sandy Hook shootings and some others were hoaxes. And a Toledo television station's hype video meant to get students excited about standardized testing might be the most cringeworthy viral video of 2019. Why? We'll talk about the why. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well before our half hour is up today. But we're going to start with the release of the Mueller report. It happened while we were on spring break, along with William Barr's four-page summary of that report. Monday, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press filed a petition in a federal court looking to have the actual report released. What exactly are they looking for in that?
Well, part of the reason that they're doing this is because they're getting increasing signals from the Attorney General that he may redact all kinds of information. Anything relating to grand jury proceedings could be redacted. Anything having to do with, quote, peripheral third parties, whatever that means. Information related to, you know, any kind of methods and sources of intelligence that might be redacted. So there's so much information that might be blacked out that both the reporters committee and also, for that matter, the House Judiciary Committee, I believe, voted today to say they might subpoena that report so that we can actually see the supporting materials behind whatever it is that Robert Mueller concluded.
And I think that that's been something since the report came out that the House in particular has been asking for, is not just a report, but the supporting materials, because of the decision that has been made by Mueller and then the Attorney General, that there's nothing else there that could be, you know, lead to indictments and that sort of thing. So they're saying, whoa, wait a minute. If that's the case, then if you don't want to do that, then we need to see not just the report, but all the other material that was put together that led to the report, so that we can make a determination as to whether or not we want to bring some charges. So, you know, that's part of it.
And journalists are never going to make these arguments, but some people could make a legitimate argument for some of the reasons that the Attorney General has given for redacting material. It's just that nobody trusts anybody. Should we make sure we don't expose methods and sources for intelligence? Sure, but that can be used, that can be defined in such a broad way that we don't get information we deserve. On the other hand, the Judiciary Committee already has in place procedures for seeing that kind of information, but then nobody trusts them not to leak. So there's lots and lots of reasons why nobody seems to trust anybody, and maybe that's why, more than anything else, the public deserves to see as much of this as possible to draw their own conclusions.
I mean, it goes back to that whole argument, I mean, age-old argument, going back to the Alien and Sedition Act of public's right to know versus securing, you know, having national security interests taken care of. And so you've got this back and forth again, and who gets to make that decision? It goes back to what you're talking about, Mike, which is the trust. We don't trust you to know whether or not the information is a threat to national security, or is it a threat to, you know, a threat to the president from a political standpoint, or even for that matter, for a criminal standpoint.
I've been trying to remember and kind of think back, going back to 1997, 1998, when the Ken Starr report came out in the case of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky and what went on in that situation. And I was trying to remember, I remember that report literally hitting bookstands, like it was published and put out there. Talk for a minute about the difference in either the attitudes towards putting it out. Like, help me remember that, because I'm trying to piece it together, well, but can't really remember how that came down and why this feels so different.
Well, and you can also go back to Watergate. I mean, in both of those cases, a lot of grand jury material was involved because the special prosecutors presented to a grand jury, and that's similar to what's happened here. And in both of those instances, much of the grand jury information was finally revealed, took a judge, at least in the Watergate case, to make that happen. But why shouldn't we have the same thing happen now? And that's why the Reporters Committee, frankly, is asking a district federal court judge to say, yeah, it's okay to let those grand jury information out. I think that's necessary for the public to see that.
But I don't understand why anyone would be surprised that it's not going to take court action for this. I mean, we all knew that going into this, that the president and those who support him were going to do everything in their were going to do everything in their power to try to minimize the amount of information that comes out. I mean, it happened during the Clinton administration. It happened going back to Watergate. I mean, even during the second Bush administration on various things where they had to literally go to court in order for the information to be released. And so I don't understand why there seems to be this big surprise by that, by some people.
Okay, so Harvey Weinstein, Matt Lauer, Al Franken, Donald Trump, now Joe Biden. Nevada State Assemblywoman Lucy Flores came forward with a piece in The Cut. That's one of the vertical publications associated with New York Magazine. And she described an encounter with the former vice president and former senator at a campaign rally in 2014. Her first-person account went into detail how he smelled her hair and kissed the top of her head.
Part of the reason why I decided to finally say something is because those behaviors were not being taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. They were not being considered from the perspective of the woman on the other side of that power dynamic, on the side of on the receiving end. And I just can't imagine that there was never a situation where someone said to him, Vice President, Mr. Vice President, you probably should stop doing that. You mm-hmm. should probably stop touching women in that way. You should probably keep your hands to yourself.
There have been other photos to surface, like the one of Biden's hands on Stephanie Carter. She's married to Ash Carter, the former Obama defense secretary. It was at his swearing in, and the photo shows a situation that aligns pretty much directly with what Flores says she experienced. But Carter is saying in a post that she put onto Medium that this is the Me Too moment that wasn't me. That was actually her words.
Well, and because her husband and she have been friends of the Bidens for a long time, she said that she had fallen on the ice right before the announcement, and he was just coming to make sure that she was having a good day, and she accepted it for that. On the other hand, I don't think we need to say there are only two examples of this behavior. I mean, Joe Biden is a touchy-feely kind of guy, and some people like it and some people don't. I think it's clear that what Flores said happened. I mean, Biden's not denying that it happened, only how it's being interpreted. And I think nobody would deny even that there's politics involved in the timing. Flores acknowledged, I wanted to come out now because he's thinking of running for president. And I think that's important. None of that mitigates from the fact that you have a 76-year-old white man who's a politician, who's been around for a long time, possibly seeking the nomination of a party that's increasingly young and female and with a more of a leftward tilt. So this is a really important story, and I'm glad that we're telling it with maybe a little bit more sophistication than we would have a couple of years ago before the Me Too movement.
I would say a lot more sophistication than we would have been covering this, say, even back in, a year ago. Mm-hmm. And we're asking a lot of the questions, not only of the politicians involved in this and the business leaders and others who are involved in this, but we're also asking the questions of those who are accusing, which I think even 6 months ago would have said that we were doing more questioning of one side as opposed to the other. So I think you're right in terms of the sophistication of how we're doing it. And I also think that we're looking at the issue more holistically and in a way that actually brings information and not just conjecture. So I'm hoping that we can do that.
So talk about how the first-person account can help to lead to some of that. Having the person, like in this case, Lucy Flores, outline and really just tell her own story as opposed to that going through a reporter or an editor's filter.
I think that's the important part, is we're allowing people to tell their stories from the way in which they experienced it, and we aren't sort of throwing in our own idea of what that was. And I think social media gives us gives them that platform to do that. And I think that reporters, including the clip that we saw here, are allowing them to do that and not just jumping in and asking a question and interrupting and asking for clarification. Initially, let them tell their story, and then you can pose those questions. I think more of that is necessary so that, you know, they can feel validated and their stories can feel validated, because in a way, I mean, they are authentic.
No, I think it's valuable that we're allowing this that we are being forced to allow it to happen.
Yeah.
Is probably the right way to say it. I think it has much more impact on the person being accused, because somebody can empathize with somebody telling their own story the way they want to tell it. Now, some people think that Biden might be able to ride it out. I don't know. A lot of other people have.
But,
Trump, Jussie Smollett. I mean, you name the people. Yeah. The governor of Virginia.
Virginia, right.
But I know there's going to be an awful lot of continued scrutiny and a lot of emphasis from several other candidates if in the Democratic presidential nomination.
And that's going to be the interesting part, because, I mean, this is not just Biden. You're going to see these types of stories come out on every single candidate. And the one person where that sort of has been able to rise above this is the president. I mean, and he's been a master at waiting it out. And I think a lot of it goes back to, if you look at who his supporters are and who his base is and how they defend him, that's much different than what you see in the Democratic Party, because Mike is right. The party is younger. They demand more authenticity from their candidates, and they want to have a full and thorough questioning of what's going on, and not just who you are now, but where did you come from to get to that point.
Okay, so I'm not going to play any of the video or the audio from the 3 hours long deposition that Alex Jones, the host of InfoWars, gave. That was posted last week. But I am going to ask Mike and Ernest to respond to it. He claims that all of those false statements that he had been making for years about the shootings at Sandy Hook, and then even some of the mass shootings and tragedies that we've seen after that, where he just kept calling everybody involved crisis actors and that they were all hoaxes, it's the result of a psychosis.
I almost wish that that were true. I wish I could believe that Alex Jones was simply psychotic when he's doing all these things. But no, he's a master manipulator. He knows exactly what he's saying. And now he's trying to play himself off somehow in these depositions as the victim. Well, he's not the victim. Here are people who are the victims. The father of the Sandy Hook kid who committed suicide recently, or the two students from Parkland who committed suicide recently, after Jones's followers and a whole lot of other people have been stalking them, attacking them on social media. Those are the folks who are the victims, not Alex Jones.
Now, I would agree with that. I mean, I think what's happening here is that he realizes that his day of reckoning is coming, and he's looking for any kind of excuse to sort of, you know, get out of that. And it's not going to happen, because if this is going to be his defense in front of a jury, he's got problems.
It's laughable. It's almost like the Twinkie defense of 2019.
Here's the part I don't understand.
Okay.
Is, you know, what makes him think that that's going to work when there is a huge body of evidence built by him against everything that he's sort of laid out in these depositions? I mean, if you listen to the depositions and you just read some of what he's saying, go like, how in the world can you come and say this now after all of these years of hoaxes, you know, basically claiming people were denying this or that Sandy Hook was somehow staged? I don't understand where his lawyers are going with this.
Okay. Yesterday, we voted here in Columbia, re-electing Brian Treese, the mayor. It was a pretty hotly contested race, but it's nothing compared to what's already going on down in Georgia, where meetings are happening and candidates and other interested parties are gathering to talk about the November 5th election. One such meeting happened last week at a church, and on the door was a sign that said only the black press was allowed inside. When I first saw it, I thought, okay, that meant that they were inviting publications that tailor to the African American community. No, they meant the only journalists allowed inside were black reporters. WJCL's Stephen Moody was one of those allowed inside, and he questioned candidates and participants about what happened and if they supported this action.
I think this is America. I think people have the right to be able to assemble. and to determine the rules of their assembly.
Johnson, who is currently on city council, said that he was asked to speak to share his vision for the city of Savannah.
Again,
we're not talking media versus non-media, we're talking white and black.
Well, I mean, again, I'm just talking about, I've been invited to meetings, and so I'm invited to a meeting to give a statement. I came and I gave a statement.
Would you go to a meeting if only white press was allowed to attend that meeting?
If I was invited to a meeting, and I'm sure I will be. If I am, I'll go there.
Johnson wasn't the only public figure to show up. Chatham County Commissioner Chester Ellis, former Savannah Mayor Edna Jackson, and Alderwoman Estella Shabazz all made appearances.
I don't have anything to do with this. I walked out of my car, I came up, and I'm going inside of the meeting. So I don't know who put this on. I don't know anything about any of this.
We mentioned that only black media was allowed. This was Van when asked about his opinion on that issue.
Oh, I was denied entrance.
I think that's unfortunate.
So the meeting was held in a private place. It was inside a church, so there's no legal reason they had to let any media in. Why restrict in this way?
I have no idea why. What my question would be to the politicians who showed up at this meeting.
Why'd you go in there?
Why did you go in there?
And that's what he was trying to get at.
It doesn't matter that you didn't know who threw the meeting or any of this. Those are questions you should have asked. Okay, who's putting this meeting together, and why are you restricting the media from being able to come in? Regardless of their ethnicity, they should be allowed to come in. If I'm supposed to be representing all the people, then I want to be in a public forum where all the people are allowed to come in, including the media, regardless of their ethnicity. I mean,
because they're going to be reporting in a way where their reporting reaches audiences of all ethnicities.
Right, right. I mean, or if you're going to say, okay, you know, this is going to be a private meeting, then you restrict everybody. You can't just say, okay, we're only going to let the black people in and all the white people stay out. I mean, but we're going to invite the politicians to come in. And if I'm a politician and I'm representing everyone, it needs to be an open meeting.
I mean, I agree with everything that's been said so far, and I just add one other thing. I'm a little confused as to why black reporters went into that meeting
that's
white
my next question. If you're that guy
inside.
Moody, who was the one reporting out that piece, do you go in or do you stand in solidarity with the rest of the journalists who are being held out? Or do you go in there to figure out what's going on in there that they don't want other people to see?
You may want to be in solidarity with the other journalists there, but you don't know what his editor said. His editor may say, hey, you know, I need you to be in there. Somebody needs to be in there to go out and report to the public what's going on. So, I mean, you don't know. And sometimes solidarity can keep you away from the story. If I'm the reporter and I have an opportunity to go in, I'm going in. And the first question I'm going to ask is, why are they out there?
And that's the thing we don't know yet, because we haven't heard from the reporters who were inside the meeting. At least I haven't seen any of their reporting.
I haven't seen anything.
So we don't know what their
answers
are.
Well, except that guy.
Right. Yeah. But the thing that I'm concerned about is that there was this, I think, an assumption on the part of the organizers. They stated it, that the purpose of the meeting was to ensure that the black community in Savannah got behind one candidate to make sure there was a better chance of being elected mayor. I hope that if they assumed that those black journalists going in there were part of that mission, that they're wrong about that.
Oh, I hope so too. And the other problem I have with that is, you know, that goes back to the whole mentality of one person speaking for all people, for all certain people. And that's not going to happen. That's not the way elections are run. I mean, not unless, you know, you're buying and paying for people, which is what has happened in the past.
Okay, so that happened on Wednesday. And in a completely unrelated move on Friday, the Associated Press issued new guidance to its members on how to refer to racism and racist acts. Enough with calling things racially motivated. Call them what they are, racist. And this is a really big move. What spurred the change?
Well, what spurred the change is Stephen King, if I'm correct on that.
From Iowa, yeah.
From Iowa. The House rep who has basically been ostracized not only by the Democrats, but also by his own party and a lot of people in his own congressional district, even though, you know, they continue to reelect him. And he keeps making these statements over and over and over again. And these are blatantly racist statements, but, you know, journalists And I understand, you know, that you don't know what someone feels in their heart and in their mind, and so they couch
trying
it.
Trying to avoid putting the value judgment.
Right, absolutely. And so they'll say, well, it's racially tinged or racially influenced. You know, they use all these sort of code words in trying to explain what he's saying. He's gotten to the point where the only explanation is that was a racist statement, flat out. You know, and so now we're having this huge argument about whether something is racist if it's not. I would say focus in on what the person is saying, and if the statement that they made is racist, then you say the statement itself was racist.
Yeah, I was interested because the AP said in justifying why they were making this change mm-hmm. in their style was that we shouldn't have to consider as journalists what was the motivation or what was in their heart when they said something. If it was racist, then you can call it that. I don't disagree with that statement, but that's really the heart of why a lot right. of journalists have used all of these euphemisms. And I think the euphemisms have not served us well. I mean, look at the same kind of argument came about a couple of years ago before Trump when we started saying, well, you can't call somebody a liar because they lied.
Absolutely. Right? We had that conversation. Right? We had that conversation on this show. It's like, wait a minute, why are we sitting there having a whole conversation about whether or not he lied? The man lied.
And if he said something racist, it's racist.
It's racist. Yeah. Another one of the changes, and this is one people have been very excited about as well, is the removal of the hyphen when talking about different communities, about the Asian American community, the African American community, that hyphen has been seen for generations as a microaggression, and that the Associated Press is saying it's time to lose the hyphen.
Well, I mean, it goes back to something that I said. You can actually ask the person, how would you like to be identified? And then get away from all of this.
And that also goes back to what we were talking about with the first person account and the authenticity that
Absolutely.
Comes from doing that,
Absolutely.
As opposed to creating artificial constructs to try to broadly appeal to everyone. There was one other change in the Associated Press guidance that I'm trying really hard to understand the outrage over. And maybe it's because in my spare time, I'm also a graduate student. You do a lot of research, so you're writing in both Associated Press style and in academic styles, APA or Chicago style. And in other sorts of writing, you use the percent sign. In Associated Press, AP style, journalistic writing, you spell out the word percent. I heard that AP is going with, it's okay to use the percent sign. I went, all right, cool. I don't have to remember what I'm doing. Journalists are as angry as can be about this. And I can't for the life of me figure out why.
We don't like change. We don't like change. I learned it. Everyone else should learn it. This is the way it should be. It should stay this way.
So what side are you on? Like team percent sign or team spell it out?
I don't care.
It's interesting because I don't care about the sign, especially if it's in, you know, text that's meant to be read. As broadcasters, you know, we always spelled it out because you were afraid if you were on the air live that if you didn't spell it out, you might not say it correctly.
Or you might not see it.
You might see it.
Not see it.
But, you know, I would say that this is kind of like the whole, you know, over, under business.
More than, do not mean the same thing.
But we got to give it up.
More than my dead body. Yeah. Okay. Some more changes. Some over change. Okay. To talk to you about Mark Zuckerberg is changing his mind again. Maybe he is a publisher, and maybe he does want to get into the news distribution business after all.
Mark Zuckerberg changes with whatever the reality of
his business.
His mind
changes faster than some people change their socks.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously he's saying, oh, well, we might have a curated quality news tab on Facebook. Well, good for him.
With a team of people who know what they're
doing.
He's
saying we might pay publishers for their information. Well, good for him. None of this would be happening if regulators were not looking over their shoulder. Yep. And if Congress wasn't considering a bill right now that was introduced just a couple of days ago to maybe let publishers get together without worrying about antitrust issues to negotiate with the big tech platform.
I also think he's tired of paying those huge fines over in Europe for this kind of thing. I mean, to me, he's trying to fix a problem that really he's not going to be able to fix unless he gets everyone in the room. He comes to an agreement and he sticks by the agreement. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem that Mark Zuckerberg has had for a very long time is that he makes agreements with journalism organizations, and then as soon as it's convenient, he changes the mind, he changes the algorithms, and then everything goes into a flux.
Okay, very quickly, we are now about a week or so into Apple News Plus. What's this for people who haven't really caught on yet?
So they're splitting the revenue with publishers. Apple gets 50% of like a $9.99 a month subscription, and all the publishers divide up the rest of the scraps depending on how many people read their articles. Why are publishers doing this? Because they're doing a terrible job of getting subscriptions on their own, and so to have millions and millions and millions of additional eyeballs on their content, they're willing to do a deal that maybe doesn't make great economic sense, but it's more money than no money.
Okay. That's true.
Before we go, I've got to ask you guys about this one from WTOL-TV in Toledo, Ohio.
Good morning, TPS students. It is testing week, and it's time to slay all day.
Yeet! Stay woke, beyond fleek, and get that Gucci breakfast.
Goals! Say bye, Felicia, to that testing stress. Weather's going to be turnt, right, Chris?
Yes! Toledo weather going to be V-lit during testing week. 100% chance of success. You've got this, kids. Steve, how about that traffic? Are we looking
better than We're talking turn, FOMO, won't be an issue. No traffic problems around any TPS schools to keep you from taking those tests.
So get a good night's sleep, do your best. In fact, be extra, extra.
We here at WTOL are V proud of you.
Good luck on your test, TPS students.
Okay, Mike, you were sitting there just laughing. Ernest, you're sitting there closing your eyes, shaking your head. This video never actually ran. It was produced by the TV station as a hype video to try and get students excited about standardized testing. Ernest, your wife is a teacher. You both have kids. Can you see this being something that gets people excited?
I don't know about getting them excited, but I mean, it might be something to... you know, sort of lighten up the drudgery of test week.
Okay.
And I think that was what they were trying to do. I'm not sure it hit the mark, but at least they were being...
Oh, no, it didn't get close to
okay, well, they were trying to be supportive of students in Toledo who, you know, let's be serious about this for a minute. For the past 2 years, they failed the test.
See, yeah. And I want to be actually very serious about it because you raise a really good point. For the last 2 years, they failed the test. This news station produces this video to try to get people excited. How do they then, in partnering with the school district, report effectively and objectively about those problems and efforts to try and improve teaching methods? And
I guess I'm less worried about that. I mean, some students told their teachers that they watched it a lot of times, maybe just so that they could make fun of it.
Right. Too.
But I'll say this, you know, they tried something different, and now you've got all these folks soon to go on Twitter, and they're attacking them, saying how horrible Toledo is, and right. making fun of the school. You know, here's my reaction to that.
Yeah.
Haters gonna hate.
Keep going, Mike. Keep going.
Yeah. You know, it was fun. It was not a big deal. Just let it go.
Haters gonna hate. We're going with our own memes and our own slang now.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that they were trying to do something to be positive. And there's some people out there who just didn't like it. So Mike's right, haters gonna hate.
Haters gonna hate. Okay, well, we are pretty much out of time for this week. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about each of the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs and the podcast tabs at kbia.org. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. Our program is also on iTunes and wherever you download your podcasts. These are all great ways to watch and listen to us again, to leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher with our original theme music. We'll see you next time.